Hey everybody, I'm Eli Lake, and I'm here with Matthew Iglesias in a dive log that arguably could be considered years in the making, considering I was originally a commenter, Matt, on your blog.
Were you?
Even before it was picked up by Tap, even before you were at Tapped.
Really?
I was one of the, I was one of your early, like, circa 05 commenters.
Oh man, classic. Classic Iglesias.
Classic, so... So we've been sniping each other on the internets for 5 years now, which is forever in the internet terms.
True. No, and you don't blog, but have always lurked in the neighborhood of bloggers. You do. Quite vigorously.
And we should I think so. And so the genesis of this dialogue is that we were twittering about last week, and we are going to get to this. About Helen Thomas and Netanyahu and Israel and two-state solution. And then you're like, if you want to argue about this, we can't really do it on Twitter. And I'm like, okay, let's just do a blogging heads, and here we are.
Exactly. Here right. we are. Okay. Here we are. But first...
But first, on a more agreeable topic, in the interest of comedy, with a T, I want to talk about last night's game in the NBA Finals, is where I think we're both big NBA fans.
We are. We are. Although I personally find just sort of Lakers-Celtics matchups a little demoralizing.
As a Sixers fan, I would rather the Sixers be there, obviously, and like Sixers right. have a rivalry with Celtics, but I love watching professional basketball.
Sure.
So I guess my question as a fellow, like, you blog about hoops and stuff, do you think Rajon Rondo, could you argue that Rajon Rondo is maybe, at least in the conversation, of the best point guards in the NBA?
Well, he's good. He's very good.
Yeah.
I think it gets easy to neglect Chris Paul, sort of languishing on a crappy team. But I think he's still
sure.
definitely the best all around, point guard. But, Rondo is extremely good and he's up there and I think it's good to see him getting credit. I mean, when this sort of iteration of the Celtics was put together, there's all this talk of the big three. And Rondo has been clearly better than Ray Allen and, in a lot of ways, the most important player on the team.
I think that here's why I'm fascinated by Rondo.
All right.
Because
he's
not
weird
a
looking.
Great – well, he's weird looking. He looks like a mutant. But also because he's he doesn't have a traditional point guard shot. Like, he doesn't have a good shot. So his
right.
jump shot's really ugly. And he doesn't really come across as, like, he's not a fabulous passer in the way that Steve Nash is. But he seems to be everywhere where the ball is. He's capable of, like, he had that dunk on, the put-back dunk, like he was Joakim Noah. I mean, I thought...
Yeah.
I just think that he does so many things that are beyond his height and sort of not really in the portfolio of the point guard position. And he's really creative around the rim in that, I mean, he's got an arsenal of shots near the basket. And he kind of reminds me of Allen Iverson, but less selfish, less selfish and not as much of a head case.
Yeah, he doesn't put up the volume of shots of Allen Iverson.
Right.
But I mean, he's quite... I think the comparable players maybe Jason Kidd, who, you can overlook on some level, because particularly earlier in his career, he didn't shoot well.
Right.
But, was putting the ball in the basket. And also Rondo is a tremendous rebounder.
He's an amazing rebounder.
Right, and I mean, it's easy to think, well, he's a guard, so we don't really care if he rebounds, but I mean, it counts coming from any position. And, he scores a lot off those offensive boards. It makes him a huge asset on the defense. It's big, and it's, I was just talking with the interns about Rondo versus Steve Nash, which is just such a, night and day contrast. Ultimately...
They're almost the opposite kinds of players, right?
Right.
Because Nash is all offense, and Rajon is such a great defensive player, right?
Yeah, and Rondo's such an all-around, contributor. And, I think ultimately, those are the guys who sort of contribute more. Steve Nash is fantastic, but, it's hard to win, just playing offense.
I agree. And let me ask you one more hoops-related question. If Kobe pulls it off in Game 7,
yeah,
do you have to talk about him in the same context as Jordan? I mean, it's 5 rings, 6 rings, I realize, but
yeah.
At that point, do you think you have to put Kobe up there with Jordan and Magic and, you know, Bill Russell?
I really don't. I mean, this is something I've written about, but I mean, particularly the Kobe Jordan comparison, you know, which you can do quite cleanly playing the same position. Kobe's just way worse. He doesn't get as many rebounds. He turns it over more. He doesn't shoot as efficiently. I mean, he's had an amazing career, obviously, coming into the league at such a young age, being a key scorer on so many really good teams. But, you know, those were good teams because they had lots of other great players on them, and it's just not the same as the kind of dominance that Jordan had.
Pippen and Dennis Rodman. And,
oh, no, of course. Everyone.
Jordan had some good players, too.
No, I mean, everyone plays with other good players. You know, I mean, who wins, but... you know, I mean, I really don't think you can make the comparison on any kind of level. It doesn't add up. You know, and I mean, that shouldn't detract from our appreciation of the Kobe Bryant story, right? I mean, this is a guy who, you know, like I've been watching, you know, we've all been watching for many, many years from, you know, when he was this kid and, you know, very kind of arrogant and, you know, this problematic relationship with Shaq and then the rebuilding of the, you know, it's a great story, but it's not the same as being as good as Michael Jordan.
I'm not ready to say he's as good as Michael Jordan. I'm saying if he gets the fifth ring, and I'd be interested to hear what Coach Phil Jackson has to say, having coached both of them. And then I would only say this, though, that both Kobe and Mike had that once-in-a-generation kind of killer instinct to completely take over a game. And just, I thought Kobe was going to do that, actually, in the game 5, in the third quarter, when he went for, like, 17 points. I couldn't believe, I mean, he was unstoppable. And Jordan got like that. I mean, Ray Allen got like that for a half in, I guess, game 3. But Kobe does it so consistently, and the only person who did it as consistently as Kobe, or more, you know, was Mike, obviously. So... that's my only – my point on that is that there's this one category where there's certain great players who in the most important games take over that game. Kobe has done that on a lot of occasions.
No, I mean, you know, that's not a mode of analysis. You know, I put a lot of stock in. I'm a rationalist and a numbers guy, which I know a lot of people – you know, don't like. And I mean, I do. I mean, I watch the games, and it's definitely true.
Right.
I mean, you get these moments, you know, where if you're if you're a Kobe hater, you think, you know, oh no, right? I mean, he's going to start, you know, hitting shots backwards, triple teamed. You know, and I mean, nobody beats him for these kind of like high degree of difficulty shots. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, he takes things that it looks totally undoable to, like, twist yourself around the guy and get it off. You know, and it's amazing to watch just from a fan's perspective, you know, in terms of, like, what do you want to see on the floor. So, I don't know.
Right. And then for Game 7, I mean, is it possible that we will finally see Rasheed Wallace reaching his full potential, subbing in for Kendrick Perkins, who appears he's not going to play?
Yeah.
And, being the player that everybody always knew Rasheed Wallace could be.
It seems unlikely.
He just decided. I think I'm a believer. He's from Philadelphia, and I'm from Philadelphia, and I knew people around him in high school. I'm rooting for Rasheed Wallace to have a huge game in Game 7, redeeming his reputation as something of a slacker. And
but like who becomes Sheed's backup in this scenario?
Well, there's, you know, Glenn Davis, Rasheed Wallace, and
Kevin Garnett.
And then, you know, you're obviously you're putting a lot of minutes on some guys who have some pretty
some
you
know, older,
a lot of miles on their
dudes,
knees, but
foul problems. But, I don't know. It just says. I mean, it's too bad. I mean, you don't like to see a series like this decided, you know, because of injuries.
Well, but Bynum is injured too, so it's a. I mean,
well, that's
it's
true.
A little bit of a wash.
It's fair.
A little bit of a wash.
Yeah,
I mean.
But still, I mean, that's even I would like to not see the Lakers playing the Celtics. But if I'm going to, you know, ideally, they all get to bring all their guys. So I think it's
going to be a great game. Every game, I mean, the last game was a little bit of a blow, but I mean, this has been a really great series. I was emailing some friends we've sort of considered this is like one of the best NBA series we've seen in a long time.
It's good. It's
I'm
good.
Just excited for Game 7.
And as we were saying, it features Jordan Farmar, one of two Jewish NBA players.
Yeah, there's Omri Cosby, right, and Jordan Farmar.
And Jordan Farmar, so he's, you know, a hero to our people, although not really that,
I think so.
Not really that good. He's no Omri Cosby.
He can be good. He's an energy player. I mean, the problem is that Derek Fisher is such a proven competitor in these big games that it's hard to get minutes because, you know, he's been there. Kobe totally trusts him.
Yeah, something like that. Something like that.
Okay. All right, so on to...
So we were talking or tweeting about Bibi Netanyahu and his views of a Palestinian state. Yes?
Yeah, I mean, I was originally motivated, as I am sometimes will do on Twitter, by a post that you had written saying, among other things, well, you know, Helen Thomas made these remarks about Jews should leave Palestine and go back to Poland and Russia or in Germany, and isn't this the mirror image of Netanyahu's views? And I found that to be incorrect, because there are Israeli far-right parties that have argued for what is euphemistically called transfer, but it's really just ethnic cleansing.
Right.
And Netanyahu has never been part of that.
Well, to obviously start, this is part of why I wanted to, you know, get this
yeah.
off Twitter, right? I mean, there's right. a lot of asymmetries between these situations, right? I mean, like, what
sure.
happened with Helen Thomas is a kind of, a batty old lady made a crazy remark that, I mean, people are interested in because they think, you know, it was, like, maybe revealing of, like, her real sentiments and what had been driving, you know, other things she'd been doing over the years, et cetera. Netanyahu, by contrast, is a, you know, he's a professional politician. His statements...
He's the leader of Israel, yeah.
Right. He's good at his job. You know, he runs for election and does these things. I mean, so his statements... I mean, the major statements he's made about this are very deliberate. You know, kinds of
sure.
sub presentations, and he certainly, as far as I'm aware, has not, you know, engaged in any kind of, outbursts that are on a par with, yeah, whatever. You know, they should just go move to Syria. So I mean, that's clear enough. But the point I was trying to make in response to this is that, you know, this is an opportunity, I think, to shed some light on the fact that a number of people have these kind of very extreme anti-Palestinian positions and are, you know, really sort of embraced by the mainstream. And, you know, the clearest example of this that my colleague Matt Duss has been trying to draw attention to for a while now is Mike Huckabee, who's been running around saying, you know, let's maybe, if the Palestinians need to have a state, let's make it be, you know, someplace else, right? I mean, this is the sort
Jordan,
of the old
right.
saw of, like, Palestine is Jordan, right? That
right.
we're familiar with. And, you know, nobody really seems to, like, take note of that or think, you know, it should be a problem or maybe he shouldn't have a show on Fox News.
Well, I mean, I'm not familiar with Mike Huckabee and I'm certainly not going to, you know, I'm not here to defend that view. I mean, there was for a very long time in Israel,
right,
the mainstream position of Golda Meir and even Menachem Begin,
right,
and Labor and Likud alike, they said, you know, they were completely against the notion of a Palestinian state,
right.
And then, sometime in the late 1980s, there were some Israelis who began meeting with members of the PLO in Norway.
Right.
And from that, we have the Madrid Conference and the Oslo Process and a series of other things, and that. The position of the center of Israeli politics has been a two-state solution. And as I said in an earlier dialogue with Peter Beinart, the position of the right with Ariel Sharon's decision to dismantle Gaza and start what he called there's all these euphemisms in Israeli politics and sometimes disengagement.
Unilateral disengagement.
It's all these, you know, but so yeah. Now, it's interesting because Netanyahu signed the Y River Accord as a Likud prime minister.
Right.
And the Y River Accord, of course, envisions a two-state solution. It prepares for a two-state solution. And then in 2000, in the primary between Sharon and Netanyahu, that Sharon wins and Netanyahu loses, Netanyahu is attacked as somebody who is a two-state solution person in a one-state solution party.
Uh-huh.
And then, you know, Sharon has his moment before he goes into this state of brain death,
right,
of where he says, you know what, we can't hold on to it. It was a major moment. And then Netanyahu and the Likud party, out of power at this point, feeling somewhat betrayed by this new party called Kadima, was against the disengagement.
Right.
And they certainly politicked on the idea that, you know, we left Gaza and all we got were rockets.
That was the point about Gaza, but I mean also the point of that split off of the party, right? I mean, was that Likud was maintaining a continuity with the Likud party's historic opposition to a Palestinian state, and the Kadima people were breaking with that. I know it's been changed. I actually confused myself a couple days ago Googling for Likud party platform, and what comes up on the Knesset site is an outdated version of it, in which it says things like, we categorically reject the notion of a Palestinian Arab state. Obviously, that's not Netanyahu's current view,
right?
But that's part of what the Kadima Likud split was about. The Kadima people were breaking with that tradition, and Netanyahu was not breaking with it.
That's correct. But but as Israeli politics, which is coalition and parliamentary based,
of course,
that Netanyahu is very different as the leader in the prime minister's chair than he was as the leader of the opposition. When he was the leader of the opposition, he took some views that are different than when he's the leader of the country. And as the leader of the country, he has, he gave a speech outlining, with very similar conditions, I might add, to what was in the 2000 Camp David conditions for the Israelis about airspace and so forth, with some exceptions, and certainly, you know, the Jerusalem issue is very, very thorny. And he also agreed to a 10-month freeze of new settlement construction in the West Bank.
Sure, I feel like you're coming here with the attitude that you're like Netanyahu's lawyer, I looked up your article from June 12, 2009, where I believe you got one of the, you know, some of the very earliest coverage on Netanyahu's,
I was a scoop,
you know, yes, two-state thing, right? I mean, you were the guy who broke this and explained it to the public, and you know, I mean, I think you explained it, in a friendly way, but also a quite clear way that this was, you know, a move that Netanyahu was making to try to appease pressure that he was under, while staying as close as he could to the base of his party and to the positions he'd sort of traditionally subscribed to, right? I mean, you didn't write an article that was about how, like, Netanyahu had searched his conscience and changed his mind on this. It was an article about how, as Prime Minister of Israel, in a changed political situation, he had to reposition. Right.
Yeah. There was pressure.
Right.
You know, I think from Mitchell, who said, "Could you give a speech saying you want a Palestinian state?" There's some confusion about this.
Right.
You know, he resisted, and then he gave a speech, and then, you know, he agreed. I mean, sure, this is the
right. You said you know, that the idea was, quote, to allow the Israeli leader to steer a course between Mr. Obama's view and those of his own hawkish base. Right.
Yeah.
Right. So I mean, you know, it's obviously important that these events occurred. But, you know, when we're trying to understand, you know, who people are and what their view is, right, when someone's history is that they've been a politician who has opposed a Palestinian state, who was a member of a political party that was opposed to a Palestinian state, who opposed the Oslo Accords, who, when his party divided...
But when he was prime minister, he ends up affirming them.
Right. Exactly. I mean, it's... Look, the point is that, as I see it, Netanyahu's not, like, a fanatic or a crazy person, you know, who's totally, you know, immune to reason. I mean, you saw it why. You saw when he gave this speech. You see it various times in his career that American pressure and other factors, you know, get him to move. But that he's also not a guy who his commitment is to, you know, the rightist vision of Israeli politics. He's very committed to the settlers and the settlements and to their cause. He's very interested in minimizing what he has to do. You know, he came up with conditions here that, you know, I mean, one can debate the reasonableness of them. But I mean, the goal was to make the minimal necessary concessions to Barack Obama. I mean, which is fine. I mean, you've got to – he's the leader of a country. He's got to do what he feels like he has to do. But when we're understanding American policy, we have to understand, you know, that pressure can yield reasonableness from Netanyahu and from the Likud, but that you shouldn't just extend a sort of infinite, you know, presumptions of good faith toward them.
Well, I mean, if I could, there's a huge difference between the Likud party of 1983 and the Likud party of 2010.
Sure.
Because in 1983, people in the Likud party and in Israel argued for lack of a better word, a one-state solution.
Right.
Because they believed all of the Jews in the Soviet Union would move to Israel and then offset the demographic trends of Palestinians having more babies than Jews in that area. So that was, for a long time, you know, that was their argument. Saying,
right.
Why would we ever want a two-state solution? Because there are all these Jews who have to flee the Soviet Union and anti-Semitism and so forth. They're going to come here and they're going to live in Hebron and Ramallah or whatever. To which, you know, and then, and by the way, the labor governments, even to a degree during the peace process, also continued settlement. I mean, it's a complicated point.
Right.
But the point here is that nobody thinks, I mean, okay, what ended up happening was, yes, there were some Russian Jews who came to Israel. They were even given inducements financially to move to the West Bank.
Right.
And they decided they would rather move to New Jersey and open a car wash. And that's what
happened. Well, I mean, a lot moved to Israel, too.
Well, some of them moved to Israel, yes, but I'm saying a lot of them just used Israel as a way station.
Sure, and
but
came
what
to
they
America.
Were, it turned, there was a question, I mean, like, were these, was Zionism going to really, was Zionism, like, burning in the, you know, oppressive, you know, I don't know, in Kyiv and Moscow and so forth in these, you know, vulnerable Jewish communities? No, well, actually, it was capitalism that they were really interested in. So, in a lot of cases. So, that idea that the Jewish birth rate is going to be off, or is, will the Palestinian birth rate will be offset by a wave of immigrants, Jewish immigrants, is now over. What's more, you know, there. What's more, after Netanyahu, after Sharon's sort of defection at the end of his sentient life, you have a sort of soul searching, and Likud doesn't make the argument in between 05 and 2010. You know, we need a greater Israel, you know, and we could somehow beyond reason do that. They're really making the argument that, well, the tactical pullbacks of from the decision to leave Gaza has made us more vulnerable. And if we were to leave if IDF soldiers and we were to dismantle settlements and so forth in the West Bank, then we would find these rockets at Ben Gurion and Tel Aviv and Jerusalem.
Right,
so it's a very different – but that's not the same as arguing, you know – or that's not the mirror image, rather, of Hamas, you know, whose charter says Islam will destroy Israel.
Well, look, I'm not like that interested in debating who is a mirror image of whom.
Right.
But, you know, simply you know, so I mean, when the demographic theories change, the kind of the grandiosity of the vision is pulled back somewhat in terms of, you know, how much land do we think it really makes sense to grab and stuff. But you know, it's still a political movement that's, you know, very committed to taking land on the you know, other side of the Green Line and building, you know, houses that Jewish families will move into and pushing Palestinians.
Not really.
I mean, there was a huge blow up in U.S.-Israeli relations over this. The proposal, you know, even, I mean, you know, there's a language element here, but we don't normally say that an entity that has foreign soldiers stationed on its soil, that doesn't have control of its own foreign policy, that doesn't control its airspace or electromagnetic spectrum, you know, it really constitutes a sovereign state at all.
Well, I'm arguing that, no.
You know, and it's just, I mean, the point I would make is a point about American policy, right, which is that if America wants to see the creation of a Palestinian state, then we have to take a, you know, can't take a kid gloves approach to the government of Israel toward bringing that about. We can't just assume that, you know, they're like really trying hard to bring this about, but there's some disagreements about modalities that, you know, there's a political movement that has over time been giving up on a kind of greater Israel vision, but doing so somewhat reluctantly, and that, you know, has to be understood on those terms and has to be pushed, just as we understand that, you know, Palestinian groups need to be pushed on, you know, particularly, you know, like right of return and other such issues, which, you know, they're not like eager to come out and say, you know, this isn't going to happen, and that will only happen if they're faced with pressure from real people, and that a similar kind of treatment needs to be accorded to the government of Israel if we're serious about the idea of a two-state resolution.
Well, I would just say that I think there's a narrative on the among American progressives and European progressives that sees that the current government is more irredentist than it really is. I mean, last week, you know, Israeli police went to Beit El and took on these, you know, gangs of youth settlers and so forth. And, you know, there was a little bit of a violent confrontation there. So these things are continued, which really started under Olmert's government. There has been a continuing kind of not only investment economically in the West Bank, but an effort to try to ease back some of the various roadblocks there. And then, I mean, there's this question about, at least in terms of the West Bank, about the stationing of IDF troops. One of the reasons the IDF troops there are to a degree because Fatah would probably be vanquished in some ways by Hamas in the absence of another force
there. Sure, but look,
on
the question of irredentism, though, right? I mean, obviously there was a big diplomatic row between the Obama administration and Netanyahu on the subject of the settlements. This became a bit of a political, you know, issue inside Israel since, you know, the relationship with the United States is important.
Incredibly important, yeah.
You know, that pressure created a circumstance in, you know, sometimes you have political leaders who there's things they want to do, but their political base, you know, makes it difficult to impossible. It's a hard situation. You know, if Netanyahu was, say, eager to stop settlement expansion, that would have been a great opportunity to do so. Instead, obviously, he was quite reluctant to do so and, you know, put up a big fight. He, you know, took some stones from various quarters and, you know, ultimately largely prevailed, you know, which is what he wanted to do. And, you know, he's the leader of a country and, you know, go for it. But at the same time, it means that the leaders of the United States need to, you know, be real about this stuff and be willing to, you know, bring meaningful pressure to bear if they expect things to change.
But, I mean, here's the thing. I think there's a bit of a misunderstanding. I mean, there was a period, starting kind of largely in the late 70s and through, I guess you could argue, the early part of the Oslo process, where Israel was demolishing homes, building new settlements, and pocking up all of the West Bank. And this was a huge problem because this happened into the peace process, which is to say, you know, there was a complaint from the Palestinian side, which is that if you're serious about giving back all this land, then why do you keep building new Jewish settlements?
Right, exactly.
So that was, okay, so that's one thing. An irony is that, you know, the most right-wing prime minister maybe Israel ever elected, and Ariel Sharon, who was the symbolic father of the settlement movement and its greatest advocate, says this was, I mean, essentially, it was a mistake.
Right.
And dismantles Gaza and others in the West Bank, and sets up through secret agreements, unfortunately, and by the way, I would be a critic of secret agreements, which we can talk about in a little bit, but
sure.
Through secret agreements with the Bush administration, the first kind of comprehensive understanding between Israel and the United States on this very issue of the expansion of settlements and their perimeters versus natural growth. Incredibly technical stuff, but for the most part, Elliot Abrams and Doobie Weissglass managed to do more on the settlement question than anyone, any diplomats in the U.S. and Israeli before them. And that largely has stayed. It's not like Netanyahu decided to come into power and then say, screw all these other agreements. In fact, you could argue that it was the Obama administration that came into power and looked at what they considered this earlier understanding on natural growth versus perimeters and said, we don't necessarily share that. We would like to get a new agreement on settlement freeze. And they did get one. On November 2009, after Netanyahu gives a speech, he agrees to this 10-month settlement freeze. If it turns out that in September, when this settlement free 10-month period is up, Netanyahu says, fuck all of you guys, I'm building more settlements, then, you know, I guess I would revisit the point that I'm making now.
I go back to what I said before about mm-hmm. you know, I mean, are you here as Netanyahu's lawyer, or are you trying to understand?
No, I'm trying to understand. I think I gave you the context here, Matt. I mean,
I think we should probably move on to the next kind of issues here. But, you know, what I'm saying is not that these things can't happen, but that they don't happen unless there is some meaningful pressure coming from the United States of America, that, you know, there is a desire on the part of the Netanyahu administration to, as much as is practical, you know, get this land and expand these kind of settled areas. And that's, I think, you know, almost universal reading of what's going on here, and that, you know, you've constructed this kind of, you know, construct that you're creating and a few others to try to put forward the kind of most, you know, benign possible view of what's going on, but that's neither the view that Netanyahu's supporters nor his opponents in Israel, you know, have of what his political agenda is.
I'm not giving you a benign anything. I'm telling you that I'm giving you a history of a recent history of U.S.-Israeli diplomacy and negotiations on this very important issue of settlements.
Well, if you say so.
And what I'm saying is that it's possible that Netanyahu. I mean, I don't know what's in his heart. You know what I'm saying? I mean, like,
okay.
It's possible that this is a big scam and that, you know, he's going to reverse course. But thus far, the vast majority of the existing settlement construction has been in that area called Ma'ale Adumim, which is in and around Jerusalem, which the Taba Accords and other things envisioned would eventually stay in Israel and would be swapped out for Palestinian areas in the north, and is not the kind of settlement expansion that we associate with, you know, home demolition and so forth. And
wow.
So
all right.
I'm trying to make a point about the issue of settlements as they relate to a two-state solution, which is that there is a legitimate concern on the part of Palestinians that if you're going to say, okay, everybody in this area get out, we're going to build new Jewish settlements here, that erodes confidence in a peace process. Whereas I'm saying that's not going on, and as for Netanyahu's motivations, Matt. I don't know. I'm not in his brain,
really, I think this has become pointless, and you know, we
why
can,
has it become pointless? I mean,
I've said it. I mean, it's become pointless because you're acting like Netanyahu's lawyer here, and you're not acting like you know, a serious discussant of this issue.
What counter a fact. I'm not trying to be his lawyer. I'm saying – I'm giving you, as I understand
it – You are.
It,
look,
seriously,
I get it. It's fine. I mean, we can hang up or we can move on to other stuff. But, I mean, I think, you know, you're becoming – it's silly at this point.
Okay. Well, I mean, it's fascinating to me that, you know, we're having, I mean, I hope you didn't expect we would agree and that we don't agree. And
No, I'm not saying that we agree. I mean, I think, like, we've said what we have to say about this.
Okay. Agree to disagree. All right, moving on to, do you want to talk about Turkey, or do you want to talk about Islamist Turkey briefly? Or do you want to talk about Obama?
Well, let's talk about the Obama issue is more important, don't you think?
Sure.
Than Turkey? Okay. Yeah.
Well, Turkey is very important, too, I would say, but okay.
Wow. We're Americans.
What?
We're Americans.
Okay.
I care more about America.
We're Americans. Okay.
You had that good piece in Reason that was on this, largely, right?
Right.
Pretty recently.
The 9/14 presidency, which we don't have to – I've done about dive lives, and we don't have to get back to it. But it seems to me that Obama is interested in talking about what the United States does against al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups differently than Bush.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of the assertion of executive powers and what we're actually doing in theaters throughout the Islamic world, really, it's not that much different. And certainly in terms of legal justification that he asserts, or his interpretation of the Constitution and what's what I call the 9/14 resolution, the resolution for that announces that we're mm-hmm. going after al-Qaeda, the AUMF, authorization of military force, he's no different than the second Bush term.
Yeah, I think that's totally right.
Yeah, and so anyway, Bush was, and, you know, Bush officials for progressives were, you know, really flirting with, like, war crimes. I think that they were, you know, accused of being war criminals in the prosecution of the war.
Well, look, I mean, war criminal is like this hot term, right? But I mean, what it means is that there are laws of war, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they are being violated. You know, which, I mean, I think is correct.
With
you know,
Obama?
I mean, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, exactly as you said, right?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, there's a guy who's a professor who's at the UN, who's a special rapporteur for, like, targeted killings,
mm-hmm.
who argues this, saying that the drone war, particularly the CIA's drone war, is illegal.
Right.
And is a violation of international humanitarian law.
Right.
But, you know, international law is not like domestic law. It's just not. It's
No. I mean, of course it's not. But, I mean, it's just if what we want to talk about is what international law says, you know, I mean, it seems to me there's a strong case that particularly when you have non-military American personnel directing what are, in effect, military strikes against Pakistan that, you know, would seem to be violating those rules. At least, I mean, I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a specialist in this, but that's my understanding of the situation. And I don't think it's, in that particular case, I don't think it's smart because it seems to me that you could tweak the policy in such a way as to not be putting people in legal jeopardy.
Well, couple things. One,
I mean, if you cared. I mean, I wrote about this, I think, most recently in the context of the national security strategy, which I think at a general level said a lot of things I agree with. And I think that the Obama administration has made a lot of changes that I think are important in terms of the overall trajectory of American foreign policy. But on the narrower topic of what do they do in their anti-Al-Qaeda operations, there's been a lot of continuity with the later years of the Bush administration, and, you know, not all to the good.
Well, the question of continuity, I think just to give the government their due, what they would say is as follows. One, there are secret counterterrorism agreements with Pakistan, Yemen, the transitional federal government of Somalia, and I'm sure Kenya and other places like that. Okay, so they have secret agreements, which historically, as we all know, and, you know, maybe led to World War I, but there was, like, miles of paperwork of these secret understandings
right.
that say it's okay for you to operate militarily in my country, even though publicly Pakistani leaders always say they have no knowledge of it, and if asked, they don't approve.
Right.
And privately, the Pakistanis will say, well, you should give us the drones and we'll do it. And then
right.
we don't trust the Pakistanis because they're, you know, infiltrated and so forth.
Right,
as
right,
well.
Right.
So it's a complicated. So that's the first thing. So legally, they're saying it's counterterrorism cooperation,
right.
which is a stretch of a definition. Normally, that would mean training, but in this case, it actually means kinetic operations.
Right.
And then I think the other argument, which is not legalistic, but I'm sympathetic to, is that never before in the history of warfare have we had such precise ability to target bad guys,
mm-hmm.
and far better to do this than carpet bomb them or send in, you know, ground troops.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, in some ways, and I don't know that you made this argument, so I'm not going to attribute this to you,
sure.
Matt, but there was a guy named Cohen who writes for Democracy's Arsenal that almost argued that the progressive approach to what we ought to do with Afghanistan was to do more drones,
right?
Which I found that was amazing in some ways because, you know, the flip side of the drone stuff is that sometimes we don't get the right target and innocent people get killed,
right.
And you know, the enemy is mixed in with the population, so mm-hmm. even if you have the right target, you end up killing innocent people. So, I think there's a real danger on the drone issue because it's almost a cost-free military operation. It's not like there's a danger of a fighter jet getting shot
yeah.
down, you know, and you have to call the family, right? So it seems like it's an extremely attractive option for politicians of both parties, and it seems and not to get too conspiratorial or too Reason Magazine on you, but I would even more worried about the use of UAVs in the future for sort of domestic law enforcement, and
mm-hmm.
I would hate for UAVs to be you know, used in this country.
Well, you know, I mean, there are like legal concerns and there are policy
right.
concerns which
right.
have some, you know, some overlap and some don't. But I mean, I, you know, definitely my view. I wrote a review of you know, Peter Singer's book on robots and warfare.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, I definitely have this concern that the apparent costs of sending UAVs based on real or imagined secret understandings with governments to go do things.
Okay.
Well, I mean, obviously, it's quite real that there's an agreement of some kind, but the nature of a secret agreement, of course, is that I don't know exactly what it says.
Yeah, right. That's a problem. I agree with. Yes,
it's so secret.
Right.
So, I mean, it seems like you can, under that color, start undertaking a lot of measures that may not, you know, actually make sense, and it becomes extremely difficult to scrutinize them properly. You know, in principle, the dynamic between the U.S. and Pakistan is that our government would prefer to be able to do above-board cooperation, but unfortunately for us, that's not possible for the Pakistanis, so we reluctantly need to, you know, go through this tacit understanding route. But of course, on another level, it's very useful to American policymakers for the agreement to be kept secret, especially if the reason for the secrecy can be shunted onto the Pakistanis, because that way it becomes really hard to scrutinize what's happening, right? I mean, we can't demand that the military do rigorous, publicly available after-action reports on these things if officially they don't happen at all. You know, and I think that's a... As from a policy perspective, a problematic one. I also think that for the Bush administration, obviously did not think that creating a stronger system of international law was an important thing to do. So finding simple.
Well, I would object to that. But
okay. Well, I don't know. At any rate, I mean, there was much less tension, I would say, in the Bush administration between their avowed big picture policy priorities and this kind of operationalization in Pakistan than there is in the Obama case. I think that you know, what they're doing, I understand why they're doing what they're doing in Pakistan, and I can't swear to you that, you know, I would have the balls, if I was president, to tell the people who are telling me this is what we should do, that they're wrong. I try to appreciate those kind of pressures of real world decision making, but I think that it is pretty seriously at odds with what they say their big overall approach is, in a way that wasn't really true when Bush was president.
I mean, Obama has a problem in the sense that he's placed a lot of policy emphasis on U.S. rapprochement with the Muslim world. He has elevated an element of public diplomacy to a kind of strategic priority. I mean, I think that's a fair statement.
And I think that's right.
If you think that is, you know, our how the Muslim world views the United States is an important strategic priority, then one thing that you'd have to consider would be how they, because it's not like Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya and other satellite stations are not going to show images of the wrecked villages or whatever that they claim is from a drone attack.
Right.
So it's not like there isn't a public diplomacy cost to something that is ostensibly a secret or
right.
an official secret that is everybody knows is happening.
Yeah.
And then I think you raised a very good point, which I totally agree with, and I would like to see more conservatives kind of understand how important this is, particularly as conservatives are out of power now, which is that when we have secret agreements, we degrade our own participatory democracy, and there is less of an opportunity for a public scrutiny of the policy, which, when it's done right, makes things better. But
right.
I want to caveat that one point, which is that I think that there's a danger because there was a lot of the controversial programs under Bush were briefed to what's called the Gang of Eight and the Gang of 12 and the leader, this select
yes.
group of congressmen.
Yes, indeed.
And I think that, it's quite possible that some people sometimes, like on certain things, that I guess some lawmakers didn't quite know what they were hearing or they didn't understand it. But I also think that because all of it is so secret, that there's a danger, which is that when it is exposed, and it will inevitably be exposed because we have a free press and an aggressive press,
right.
That people can say that they didn't really know about it.
Right.
And that they didn't really concede to it. So that's another problem with secrecy, which is that if just for no other reason that you want political bipartisan cover, when you do everything in secret, it allows too much wiggle room for Nancy Pelosi to say she didn't remember that briefing. And I think that's the example of the kind of public accountability that is not good for the democracy, which is that every time we find out something that we sort of already knew in the back of our head already, that we reach for the fainting couch. That's not to say that there shouldn't be, I mean, there should have been, you know, like when we found out that there were black sites and so forth, we should find out what they are and so forth.
Well, right. Well, I mean, the issue, right, I mean, because as I was saying before,
right.
obviously there's certain kinds of tough calls that happen.
Mm-hmm.
When a guy in a uniform or a guy from the CIA shows up and says, we should do this, and then you say back to him, that doesn't really seem right to me. And then he comes back and he's like, no, really, like, we should do this. You know, there's real right. risks, blah, blah, blah. And then it's really difficult to be the guy who is like, no, I'm telling you, you're wrong. I'm overruling you. We can't do that. You know, whatever. Because then you have to take responsibility politically if something goes awry. And the secret briefing process is a way for Congress to, without formally abdicating the responsibility to make policy for the United States, to in effect get to say, I mean, because it's not even a question of, well, you know, did I remember or whatever. But Congress doesn't have any – they don't then, like, go take a vote. They just kind of get this briefing. So then whatever happens, happens. And then whatever public discussion occurs later, you know, they can say, you know, I didn't know, or, well, they told me but I didn't – I mean, they can say whatever they want. They don't take responsibility because they're not given any responsibility. And Congress has – it's sometimes construed that the president, like, took this power from Congress. But Congress really gave it away. I mean, they didn't want...
I'm glad to see you...
To run that, national
that's
security
a,
policy.
That's a very... that's a tip of the hat to you.
Well,
very
yeah. And I mean, that's, okay. that's yes. the problem with this dynamic. And it's also, it's why, you know, when Obama comes into office, after all this talk about executive power and, you know, appointing various lawyers to different things... you know, Congress didn't, like, show up on January 29th and be like, oh, hooray, Barack Obama just got inaugurated. Now give us back all this power. And then, you know, while he was in maximal hope and change, you know, get it all back. Instead, everyone kind of claps, but, like, they don't want the power. But it's not that they don't want the power. It's that they don't want the responsibility. So essentially, the status quo continues. I mean, what decisions are actually made in the Oval Office, you know, change to an extent. But there was this moment in the 70s when members of Congress decided that they actually wanted to reassert themselves. You know, but that's unusual and certainly is not, you know, what's happened here. And there's a huge difference between actually wanting to have operational decision-making authority and wanting the ability to sort of offer retrospective criticisms.
I would just want more openness, which is to say, one of my critiques, you know, it would have been much better had Cheney or Bush said, listen, we're in a new world, we have to fight these shadowy networks, they're all over the planet, I don't know when the war is going to end, which they did say, and then here are the new things that we're going to have to do. And then have a debate about it, and that way we know what we're getting into. And certainly there are certain things that you have to keep secret, and I'm thinking more in the realm of espionage, and I suppose that you have some latitude for agreements you have with other countries. But, I mean, I guess, let me ask you a question. The Pakistanis recently captured the deputy military commander of the Taliban, Mullah Baradar.
Right.
Okay? And I would, you know, chalk that up, counterterrorism victory, go America, go Obama.
Sure.
Okay. But do you think that in the chain of whatever happened to getting Mullah Baradar, and we haven't gotten a TikTok from anybody that's really
right.
reliable, but do you think that the Pakistani ISI and the military didn't torture anybody?
Sure. This is to some extent a longer story. But, you know, I would have would not at all be surprised to learn that they
okay, and I'm not saying I know for a fact, but
No. I mean, neither am I. I mean, but what I would say is part of the larger issue here, right, is that, like, one reason we have all these problems in the first place is that the Pakistani state is, like, not a really effective, you know, enterprise. And that, you know, it's... The Pakistani state and security apparatus has a lot of attributes of regrettable government entities, which does, in fact, lead me to believe that I wouldn't be surprised to learn that their investigative methods involve routinely torturing people. But that's not to say that I think it's a good idea that that's
how
they
proceed.
No, I'm
not saying it's a good idea either. I'm not saying we should do it. Right. No, that's not what I'm saying at all.
Yeah. No, I'm in agreement. And you obviously, in the whole realm of, like, secret diplomacy with Pakistan, I don't think you could 100% avoid it. But I think it's really problematic and that, you know, there should be much more push, I think, to try to move these things above board, because there's just tons and tons and tons of possible problems in this realm, including the fact that, as I think you alluded to, that, I mean, it's very likely that any secret agreements are not going to actually remain secret.
More than that, they're not going to remain secret. I mean, if we have these secret understandings... And then what happens if there's a new government in Yemen that's like, I don't know what secret understandings? I never heard about this. Get
right.
out. So there's that problem, which is that, you know, we're making secret understandings in many cases with governments that themselves are authoritarian and unstable. And so who knows what replaces them if we're going to still have the secret understandings. And I mean, and it allows this kind of, like, it's a diplomatic fiction. It's a useful diplomatic fiction because when everything is working and we have the secret agreements with unsavory states and unsavory entities, it allows the U.S. to have more credibility, I suppose, to go in front of the Human Rights Council and the U.N. and wave the finger at Iran and other human rights abusers.
Yeah, sort of.
And, you know, I'm not saying that that's worth nothing, but it is largely a fiction in that. And it's not a, I'm not making a partisan point here because it's not, I mean, Bush certainly expanded Lee's on cooperation on counterterrorism with unsavory regimes. But Clinton did as well. And, you know, Obama seems to be doing the same. And, you know, if there's a serious debate in this country, do we want to participate in torture? Do we want to participate with these regimes? Then it would strike me that we should have that conversation about our relationships with these institutions and these countries. And I just haven't seen it as much on the progressive side of the blogosphere. Maybe I'm wrong here, Matt. Maybe it is a burning
issue. Well, I don't know. I mean, I think there's been, I mean, and the larger theme, right? I mean, I think I've definitely seen more discussion from the left of the sort of Bush-Obama continuities, you know, than I've seen from the right. And I think it's a little, I mean, I don't know. It's
well,
been a little
there was,
strange.
There was a sense that
me.
When the left is out of power, they are.
No,
I think
there's been a certain amount of interest from the right in, you know, sort of trying to do some like hypocrisy hits on people on the left. But I mean, I just like. I haven't seen a lot of people saying, you know, I might disagree with Barack Obama's healthcare bill, but I'm really glad that he's, you know, hasn't lived up to my fears and overhauled our counterterrorism policies. You know, he's doing a great job or something like that. I mean, I don't really. I mean,
keep
I have
America
mixed
even,
feelings.
Keep America even safer.
I have mixed feelings because I'm not like, on the one hand, you know, I'm not like super eager to see policies that I don't think are great, you know, receive praise. But like, it's ridiculous to see some of these keep America safe type attacks that are, you know, really being leveled against like a fictional version of the Obama administration. I mean, it's not like, you know, it's like Obama, you know, really did like want this healthcare plan. So if people don't like it, you know, they should criticize it. But on a lot of other things, he's being criticized for sort of phantom, you know, initiatives, which is,
well, I mean,
it doesn't help people understand.
Well, I'm saying that they focused on Guantanamo and closing Guantanamo, which was a campaign promise. It's something that Obama
was
going to do. You know, so they, it wasn't
sure.
a real issue that they focused on, and they, I think they appear to have won. I don't know.
We'll right. But, I mean, there's something very, you know, very, very partisan about it, right? I mean, the idea that there was some void of policy that they were arguing over in that instance was largely, you know, a fiction. I mean, I think as a political attack, it was very effective because they found a, you know, a real wedge between something Obama had promised to do and, you know, how far people were willing to go. You know, I don't know.
You don't think the Obama White House sort of encourages it a little bit? I mean, John Brennan, you know, we're not afraid to try our terrorists in there. You know, our legal system is so great. And John Brennan is, of course, you know, he knows about all these things we've just been talking about. I mean, I think that the Obama, it's a fight I think the Obama White House would like to have to a degree because it's much less comfortable for them to have a discussion or to sort of deal with a critique along what we've been talking about here, Matt, which is how, you know, they have continued on executive power, on targeted killings, and a whole host of other things, and particularly the liaison relationships with these unsavory intelligence.
I mean,
services.
I think in general, Democratic administrations prefer not to have politicized discussions of national security policy, and the Obama administration is not really an exception in that regard.
Well, but I think they do want to have a discussion with Keep America Safe. I think that it's like,
I don't think so.
In the primaries in 2008,
yeah, in the
I
primaries.
Thought it was, in the, no, I'm saying in 2008, the primaries, Rudy Giuliani and Hillary Clinton had an interest in fighting with each other about General David Petraeus.
Okay.
Hillary, you see what I'm saying? Like, sometimes people have a debate, and they're like, oh, thank God I'm getting beat up on this, because it makes me appear to be this when I'm really that.
Yeah.
And so I think that it's
I see what you're saying. I just don't think that's true.
Okay, well, I mean, I guess so, but I mean, and I guess I would, and so I would say somewhere, in some sense, that it's encouraged to a degree, and I think that, I mean, listen, to you, Spencer, Adam, Server, all have, to a degree, and Julian Sanchez have all, you know, certainly picked up on what I've also picked up on regarding the continuities and so forth, and as just a journalist, I think, you know, it's an important story to cover. So I'm not – it's not a – and I don't want to paint with too broad a brushstroke, but back to the original question, do you think that – would you feel comfortable calling them war criminals, or would you say that they're violating international law?
I think so, yeah.
Hmm.
I mean, I'm not comfortable doing it, as you can see right there, but that doesn't mean it's not the correct conclusion.
All right. Well,
right.
I'll look for your giant puppet of Obama and Secretary Clinton, I guess.
Oh, the giant puppet.
At the next answer.
Well, I don't know. What is Secretary Clinton done?
Well, I mean, she's the. I don't know if Sarah. I don't know if I would put Clinton in that. I mean, yeah. I guess she's a senior person in administration.
Well, you know, I don't know. Well, I mean, because I mean, if we're if you're talking about real legal questions, I mean, you know.
Leon Panetta. Would Leon Panetta, would you,
I obviously, you know, this is not like a great issue to raise at the very, very end of the thing, but I mean, you know, the thing about the CIA, right, is that sort of the idea is that, well, we've created this agency whose purpose is that the president can use it to undertake, his secret illegal activities.
Sure.
You know, I don't know. I mean, I don't really know what you're supposed to say about that. It's, like, not a great idea.
That's an argument that the right was making throughout the, you know, the process in the last year when you'd see these IG reports go public and, you know, hearings, you know, with Pat Leahy and so forth. There was always this argument, well, I mean, that's why you have a CIA. They're supposed to a certain extent exist to violate domestic and international law or the domestic law of other countries, because recruiting someone to spy on their country is obviously treason. If you're, you know, it's great for you in America, but it's bad for the, you know, I don't know, South African you've recruited.
Right. So. I mean, that's what it's for. So it's not like some perversion of grand principle.
Well, do you think we need a CIA? I mean, Daniel Patrick Moynihan and a lot of other people in the past have said no.
Every time I say that that's what I think, a bunch of intelligent and well-informed people produce a lot of counterarguments to me. I guess not. But I don't know. I think it's a tough question. I'm not enthusiastic about it.
I mean, let me ask you this. Do you think... Forget the CIA for a second, Matt. Do you think that the U.S. government, in some capacity, in secret, should try to kill senior terrorists from Al-Qaeda or wherever?
Well, we should definitely try to kill them.
Okay.
Then
the question is, do you want that to be the military, or do you want that to be something else?
I think it would be better to do it through the military. I think it would be better to have something... clearer from Congress than the old whatchamacallit resolution. And I think
the AOMF, the Authorization of Military Force.
I mean, if I was Barack Obama's lawyer, as someone over there is, I can totally see, you know, the reading that they are giving to that document and why it authorizes these very wide-ranging activities. And I don't think that that's a crazy reading of it. At the same time, I mean, if, you know, just anyone who's been living through these events understands that that was not, like, what the national debate was about at that time. And if people want to create some kind of wide-ranging global Al-Qaeda killing authority, you know, we should really try to do that, you know, officially.
I'll tell you what I think. I think that Al-Qaeda is the beginning of it. I think that the nature of warfare has changed. Small, dedicated groups with resources can do the damage of what used to be of nation states. Mm-hmm. And that, to a degree, we're kind of slouching into a permanent authority that gives the U.S. the authority to go all over the world and find these non-state actors. Because eventually, I think that Al-Qaeda may, in fact, be defeated, which would be wonderful. But there will be some other group, like the Japanese Red Army or whatever it will
right.
be, that will at some point pull off a terrible terrorist attack. People will say, we can't tolerate this. We want the government to do whatever it can to listen to as many phone calls and read as many emails and kill as many people as they can to make sure this never happens again, because we have an expectation in this country, as well as people all over the Western and, well, all over the civilized world. They have an expectation that they can go to their shopping malls and those shopping malls will remain unexploded. Mm-hmm. And so if that's the expectation, then that changes, I think, everything from the laws of war to personal privacy rights and those expectations, and we have yet to have an open conversation politically about the limits on that or what we're willing to tolerate.
Yes, no, I well, yeah, I mean, I find that a somewhat terrifying vision. But
me too.
I agree in spirit with what you're doing, and you know, I mean, in the international legal aspect of this, I mean, we've had sort of time and again since 9/11 these kind of conversations where something happens or something is done, and then people are like, well, you know, these things weren't written with a modern, you know, situation in mind. And there's some truth to that, and to some extent, I think it's an evasion. You know, but at this point, this isn't like early October 2001, right? We've had plenty of time to say, look, we think we need to do some kind of rewrite. You know, here are our proposals. You know, let's see where that goes. And, you know, I don't think it's viable in the long run to just be like, well, on the one hand, here's the rules of war. On the other hand, here's our policy. You know, and on the third hand, 9/11 changed everything. You know, of course, I mean, when circumstances change, people change rules all the time in all kinds of contexts. But there should be a real effort to, you know, come up with something that is, you know, I mean, you never get anything that's universally acceptable in the international community, but at least something that's broadly acceptable and has been agreed to as some kind of principles of conduct. Because, you know, I mean, of course, we don't want to have some guy shot on the streets of Chicago and it seems like it was the KGB. And then and then have Putin saying, like, well, you know, I mean, it's a new world, like, we're just killing people on the streets. You know,
clearly,
so I mean, you want to lay down some kind of principle that's broader than, well, John Brennan and Barack Obama had a conversation, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, you got it. I mean, one of the problems with asserting all the authority is that, like, what if China or Russia assert? In fact, by Russia, we actually have an example of that critic of Putin being poisoned by radiation, I guess, polonium
in London,
I think, in 2007. Oh,
right.
I mean, I'm totally outraged by that, and I'm bad Putin. I don't want him to do that. We should.
Right.
I mean, it's wrong. But I mean, yeah, I mean, and obviously that guy wasn't a terrorist; he was a political opponent.
Right.
But yeah,
well, I mean, it's obvious
to
you
stop.
And me.
Right.
But and I mean, you know, I was just in China recently, where they're, you know, I mean, the things they have to say about the Dalai Lama are, you know, I mean, are nuts. And yet, you know, I mean, you don't want them to say, well, this is a terrorist organization; we're going to kill these guys.
Right. Well, so that's one issue. Though you could argue that great powers like U.S., Russia, and China have an interest in preventing small non-state actors from doing massive amounts of damage, and to a degree, I guess, when Bush looked into Putin's soul and found a partner, that was one of the things that they agreed on in that meeting. And I think that, you know, I guess to a degree, I mean, I don't know. I mean, the U.S.-Chinese counterterrorism relationship is a mystery to me. So I was going to say, I'm assuming that there's something like that on that side too, but I don't know. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so that's one of the problems. And then, you know, none of it seems like it's ever explicit. Right. And then finally, I would say the other problem is, of course, that it's so amorphous. What does it mean to destroy Al-Qaeda? Al-Qaeda exists on the internet. I mean, if that's the case, then, you know, maybe the approach should be, you know, like cyber war. You know, like you go after all of their websites. I don't know.
I've legitimately got to go. So with
me too.
Big, hazy thoughts of cyber war, let's wrap it up.
All right. Thanks, Matt. Okay. This was good.
Good talking to you.